Welcome to Ever Beyond, on Wolf Spirit Radio and everbeyond.info and No Borders Radio. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond. Well, good evening and welcome to Ever Beyond. This evening we are talking with a dear man, an esteemed man, we were insisting on that, Thomas Sheridan. We've spoken before, and so we know a little bit about you, and I just want to kind of jump in here, you know, just kind of drop straight into it, really. Yeah, the stuff at the beginning, the theme tune is one of my little tunes. I play with this thing called Reason. Have you heard of Reason, Thomas?
I haven't. Hi, JP. It's great to be back on the show again. Reason, yeah, it's like an internet music making thing where you have these like sort of virtual patching things on the back of a mixer.
Yes.
I tried using it and found it unbelievably complicated. So you like it?
Well, I don't know if you ever played with one of those early drum machines, the Roland TR-303.
Yeah, I had one.
Yeah. Well, if you get into that mental mode, then Reason is just a bunch of modules like that. But what you can do is you can have one drum, you know, one is when you've got a drum machine, you've got a sampler, and you can set up patterns and rhythms and all that stuff. It's tricky to learn to get to your first tune. Once you've got the idea of how to make it, it's very, very straightforward. And it's like having a band that you don't need to shout at. It's great.
Oh, that's cool.
So you've played in bands before, and you write your own music, don't you?
Yeah, I still do. I'll never stop. I can't read music or anything like that. I'm not the world's greatest musician, but I can play guitar to a competent level, and I can passively play keyboards and piano. So between the two and my not so good voice, I can do things that actually reach the levels that you know I'm happy with.
Yeah, and you know, I think you've been playing probably about the same length of time as me. So you know, just because I play the lead guitar doesn't mean you're a better musician, because that you're not a better musician, because the whole thing that I've been trying to achieve over the years is to get to express what I really feel and the notes in my head. And I can see you're more on the right brain side of things, so I'm sure you've got a lot of that better. And this is what the show's about. It's expression of the soul, expression of who you really are. So I mean, tell us about your latest song that you've written. What's it about?
I don't know. What was the last? I'm trying to think. Oh, I'm working on a piece at the moment. I'm writing a soundtrack for a film I'm making. It's in very early days, but the film will be about a journey through human consciousness. It'll be the discovery of the modern shaman. So I've been playing around with some sequences and some guitar pieces for that, and it's in the early embryonic stages, but I think it's going to come quite well. My last piece of finished music was an instrumental called Moonlight, and you can get that on my YouTube page or SoundCloud, and I'm very, very happy with that came out. It was just a drift away guitar piece that, like, it was exactly what I wanted to sound like. The guitar was very responsive that night. I have a Telecaster, and I also have a Firebird as well. But the Telecaster was really singing that night. It had new strings on it. And it's a very simple piece of music, but I was very happy with it.
You know, sometimes the simple gives, it's the very subtle changes in the simple that produced the nuance, that produced the feeling of it. And really good luck with the film. It's great that you can make the film, you can direct the film, and even produce its own music, which is, to me, the music in films is one of the unsung but most important parts of being able to put the soul expression in, don't you think?
Oh, it's crucial. I've been watching a lot of films lately where I've been watching interviews with the film score, the guy who did the score, and you wouldn't believe how it's almost alchemical in many ways how the best film scores are created.
Mm.
I'm very interested in the idea of the soundscape. That's always been my approach. Even when I played in band and we were playing 5 and 6 minute songs, I was very much interested. I used to, it's funny, the bands that I was in, the guitar, I tended to use lots of effects like chorus and analog and digital delays and to create a texture. And in some bands I've been in, it's the bass player has literally almost been the rhythm guitar player. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
The guitar that I would play was more like, almost like a synthesizer, a keyboard. It was just, I'm pretty good at coming up with riffs and stuff like that. But generally, I do love that soundscape feel.
Oh, yeah. Well, it sounds like, you know, we do a good jam together. I'm into the similar kinds of things and soundscapes, as you say, you know, making a soundscape. I used to just take a tape recorder and record like 4 or 5 tracks on top of each other in a row without any listening. just like play one after the other and after the other and after the other. And it would always create some really quite multi-dimensional feeling of music that most of the time worked, and you could always tweak it and, you know, take out the really nasty discords, but it makes a lovely thing. I'm assuming you're around the same age as myself, and you probably started messing about with guitars about the same time, and using echo reverbs and all those effects units. Back in the day, it was all separate little boxes. I've got one of these.
Yeah, like my setup was very basic. I had a Boss distortion pedal. It was the overdrive, the yellow one. And I had the Roland flanger. And next to that was a Roland chorus pedal. And then I had the Memory Man analog echo. And so the three were patched in, and I used to split the guitar into two feeds. So I had 2 amps on the stage so one amp got a pure feed of just the guitar, right? Just the basic electric guitar. And then the other amp got the feed of the effects.
Yep,
and then
yep,
two of them were patched again on either side of the stage, and it was a stereo chorus. And that would be the last one in the link. And so you used to be able to create these enormous sounds on stage where the sweep from the chorus would go from one side of the stage to the other. It was absolutely brilliant. I used to love it. I mean, you didn't need drugs after that, you know?
No. Brilliant, brilliant. Yeah, very much similar to what I was doing at the time. I was using the echo to split the signal, so I'd have one main one, and then the echo would be going off into some very kind of woolly little place, you know, on the other side of the stage. So that, yeah, so interesting, interesting, Thomas. So we go from making our music to saying our words, and you've got a blog. And you got a radio show, and what else do you do?
I write books, I paint, I make films, I got a website, a blog, and a YouTube channel. And well, that's about it, really. I make music.
That'll do. That'll do. Pretty much, you know, what they call a Renaissance character.
That was, you know, I grew up in a kind of a very poor, disadvantaged neighborhood, and so that was always the way out. It was either you became a professional footballer, if you couldn't kick a ball, you might try to be a boxer, And if you couldn't do that, well, then the way out would probably be trying to do something creative, to join a band or something like that. And so it was came out of necessity to want to sort of better my life. And I have to say it did. I mean, you know, the doors, my creativity as a teenager opened phenomenal doors for me in my life in my 20s and 30s and still to this day. So, you know, parents, if you have young children, you know, encourage the hell out of them to be creative, because they're actually going to create magic that will unfold in their lives forever.
Absolutely. My son has just discovered, I think we've just found his passion. He's got a camera that makes movies, and he's doing stop frame and
animation, yeah,
and all of that stuff. So, and he watches movies, like he watches two movies a day at the same time as doing gaming and at the same time as doing his homework. Homework suffers a bit, but who cares? He's being creative, you know. We have this thing, me and my ex-wife, obviously, you know, that she wants to, you know, go and have an education. But, honey, he's dyslexic. The reason is he's dyslexic. He doesn't see things the way you see them, and he's not academic, but.
Yeah, and also, if students have extra curricular creative things, that should actually be put onto their final exams as a passing mark or something, you know?
If we
had a real education system.
That would be a very interesting, I might suggest that to them, you know, just like, watch what he's done when he's not been doing the work. This is what he's passionate about. I may put one in for that, because they're all very disappointed in him, you know, because he's not interested in what they're trying to tell him. He's got his own, he's bursting with his own stuff. And that's, I think, with the, you know, the children of today, this is all this ADD and all this rubbish, is because they're bursting with their own knowledge and information that they actually need to be telling the teachers, no, this is not true. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's actually, and I was one of those students as well. I was incredibly bored in school. And that was basically it. And I mean, I didn't do terrible in school. I finished my final exams and I got into college, but I dropped out of college in the first year because I just completely had it with formal education by the time I was 18. I couldn't stomach it anymore.
Yeah, well, me too. I couldn't go to college, but I actually ended up working at a college, working at a university. So I had the great advantage of, you know, having student facilities, being paid and not having to do the exam. So that worked for me, I tell you.
Oh, that's nice.
So you had you've been painting now. Ah, I have questions. Oh no, not necessarily questions, but I have some feedback. In the chat room before. That's right. Ah, right. Okay.
Oh, and I write comedy as well. I forgot about that. I've written. I still write comedy. I'm hoping to do some stand-up gigs actually. So there's another one.
Ah, stand-up. Now, that's something that I really, really love. I'm a great fan of stand-up because you gotta be on the ball. You have to be in the moment to do stand-up. And you have to think, you know, not even think, you have to almost like channel whatever words are coming through, just let them come out because they're bound to be funny, you know, just kind of it's like trusting in yourself.
Well, a comedian here in Ireland who's kind of well known has asked me to kind of develop a show with him because he's into a lot of stuff like, you know, the woken up consciousness stuff and things like that. So he's presented me an opportunity, and it's something I used to write comedy, you know, like political satire and stuff like that. And so I would like the idea to present that in some kind of show to an audience. So it probably wouldn't be, if it comes together, it probably won't be stand-up. It'll be more like a kind of a review. Like what, you know, like a kind of a, I don't know what those kind of shows that, like the Goons or something like that, you know?
Like, like a series of vignettes and sketches and
things. Yeah. Like something like that I'd like to go for, like Derek and Clive or, you know, that kind of a thing.
Oh yes. It's like, you know, if it was music, it would be an album of different genres.
Exactly, yeah, but they'll all be sort of like rooted in, I do think there's not enough fun in this movement. There's still a lot of people who are uptight, for whatever reason, but you know, as I've written two books about psychopaths, one of the things I've learned to put them down. There's two ways to deal with them. One is you have nothing to do with them ever again. And the other point is you can laugh at them. And when you laugh at them, you rob them of their power.
Ah, yes. The humour factor. Because, you know, we can't... there are some people that we're not going to be able to completely cut out of our lives. Yes. But the humour works.
It's like on my radio show, I do things like I have jokes now and again. Like I have skits and I channel people who aren't dead yet and things like that for a laugh. So, you know, we have a lot of humour.
Channel people who aren't dead yet.
Yeah, Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan. You think Bob Dylan should be dead by now, shouldn't he? You should be able to channel Bob Dylan.
I was channeling Alan Watts as a joke bit, and somehow Bob Dylan became my spirit medium, and it became very funny. And I channeled the Egyptian god Ra, and he gave me diet tips and stuff like that.
Oh gosh, excellent. So, I was just going to say, if you're in the chat room and you wish to add any comments to Thomas or myself, yeah, you can comment on me. I don't mind. I get it, you know, I've got this YouTube channel, right? And I've had these two interviews with some big names in the sort of alien disclosure kind of world. And I've had loads and loads of views of it, like, you know, dozens of thousands. I'm running about 96% popularity at the moment. Like most people don't mind me, but 5% say, this guy is terrible, he should give up. I love it.
That's great.
I love it. It's good to have a bit of traction.
Yeah. congratulations, you're doing well.
So, now, there's a question here. This is a question from Moon, who has wandered off. Moon's from the Netherlands, and she'd like to know at what age you started. And, I mean, you kind of gave us about that, but...
Started what, masturbating, or...?
Exactly, I don't know. I don't know exactly. She was looking at your site, so I don't know what inspired.
Painting, maybe.
Yeah, I think it's painting. I don't think she would have asked that. Generally, well, she's from Holland. You know, they're pretty open minded there.
When did I start painting? I don't know. I mean, my very early memories of tearing open cereal boxes like Weetabix and Ready Breck and using the back of them as a canvas. And, you know, I don't know, forever. Professionally, I saw my first painting back in the early 2000s at a job I was at. I brought in some paintings one day, just as I talked to one of the girls in the office. She was a secretary who was taking an art course. And I said, I'd do a bit of painting myself. And this was about 2004 or something. And I brought in some watercolors I'd done just to show her, you know, just to show her, like, not just to give her ideas, and I give her some techniques on painting. And the manager in the office sees them, and he bought them all on the spot. And then I started selling paintings, and I was actually making my living from it until about 2009, when the economy in Ireland collapsed and people didn't buy art anymore. And then it also kind of went down everywhere else as well. I saw the watercolor a couple of weeks ago, you know, so not for a lot of money either. You just can't get the kind of money you used to get. But I don't make a living from painting anymore. It's purely just, you know, a passion at this point. But I'm also saving up painting because I do want to do a proper big exhibition one day.
Ah, that's fantastic. So, I mean, really, it was like she affirmed something in you, didn't she?
Well, yeah, it was really the boss that did it, you know, when he saw it and he says, Jesus, you're brilliant. And that was...
That always helps.
Yeah, you know, so it kind of came from... Then I made websites and I started selling them on early days of eBay. And they were selling like hotcakes, so I can't... And I used to make Celtic art as well. And a few, not too much of that, just a bit of it. Like, I used to make these Celtic crosses that I used to carve them out of wood. And I started making the first one as a present for a friend who was religious in hospital. And the next thing you know, I was selling them as well. So it was the funniest thing. I never meant to become a professional artist, but yeah, I actually pulled it off there for a few years, surprisingly.
So there you go. Artist, fine artist and sculptor. Yes. The list grows, Mr. Sheridan. There's another question. Now, this is pretty abstruse, and I don't know if you can hook on to what she's saying. He seems to be bothered by people who were in outer space, so to say. Like to know.
Bob Geldof hasn't been to outer space yet. He's due to go next year. How do you mean? Like, I'm bothered by people who have been to outer space, like astronauts?
I think she's talking about people being in a different headspace that bothers you. Something like that? Have you written anything about that?
Oh, you mean like aliens and things like that?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe people who claim to have been in outer space. Maybe that's what she means.
I don't know anyone who's been in outer space, so I can't, other than astronauts. Maybe things like astral traveling. I can definitely see that's true. I think that kind of happened to me accidentally once. If you want to know my opinions on the whole UFO aliens thing, I have to be honest and direct and say I don't believe in 90% of it, 99% of it. I think most of it is actual explainable things or secret military projects, but the genuinely unexplainable and truly amazing stuff to do with aliens and things, I believe firmly are rooted in this human consciousness and in this reality. I don't think it has any, this is just my opinion from my years of research. I don't believe it has anything to do with people from other planets visiting Earth or the Earth or anything like that. We'll put it this way. I've yet to see any proof that's convinced me of that.
Okay.
But I'm open-minded. I'm not like negative about it. I'm not closed-minded about it. I'm just giving my opinion of what I, from my own research. And I have looked into it.
Yeah, well, personally, I've never seen anything myself. Actually, I stood outside just before the show just to get some air, and it's a fantastically clear night here for the first time in bloody months, and the Pleiades were rising in the east just at the tip of Rigel, just coming over the horizon. And the Milky Way just flying above the head, and then a shooting star comes across, and I thought, that's nice. Yeah. This is the bit of the year that I love, the winter months when you see this huge vault of sky. Sometimes you don't need to travel, just being able to watch that that's TV enough for me.
Yeah, I agree. I'm big into that stuff as well. I mean, I live in a fairly rural area too. We get the Northern Lights now and again. I'm sure you get them up there where you are.
Oh yeah.
And that's enough for me. Now, I actually do. Is there people on other planets? I'm sure in terms of numbers wise, there are some kind of intelligent life out there. The thing is that we have heard absolutely nothing. So I'm actually on the fence about this stuff. A part of me wonders if we really are the only planet in the universe that's like inhabited to the level of consciousness that we are. And that's a terrifying but also awesome prospect that we actually might be responsible for the universe. And there's a part of me that really does believe that. I do believe that like the universe is created from human consciousness.
Well, certainly, the universe that we currently reside in is like, I've been trying to look at this, the sort of the natural consciousness of humanity and how it can be reprogrammed. I've had a lot of shows about MK Ultra and the mind control experiments.
Yeah.
And other government black projects, Searle effect generators that are gravity cancelling and float above the laboratory and things like that. I've been building up a bit of a picture about what's been going on. But what seems to be the case is that we have an extra group of humans, let's put it that way, that we are watching on science fiction films. And like you say, they're military. It's all military. You always notice in the science fiction, there are always a military kind of command sort of structure. You know, you never have rebels.
Yeah, you had Blake 7. That was the only show I can remember where you had kind of vagabonds.
That's right, rogues. Handsome rogues.
A superb rated TV show back in the early 80s. People should watch that if they can get their hands on the DVDs and stuff. It was a very intelligent, even though people just slag it off because the special effects, they'd say, were rubbish. But so what? The stories were brilliant, and that's the important thing of all. And this is another thing that happened too, is that when they got really good at special effects, our opinion of sci-fi had to be determined by the level of special effects and not by the substance and quality of the storyline and the themes and the motifs and the allegories and the archetypes contained within it. And so that was a great disservice, the likes of, you know, okay, it is impressive when you see the first early films that had great special effects, like 2001, Star Wars, and even the first Star Trek TV show had superb effects for its time. But what happened then was the substance in science fiction definitely went away, and it was replaced by how many spaceships you could have flying in all different directions at once.
Yeah, all the different like CGI wars. Did you ever see a show called Babylon 5?
I've never seen it. I know about it, though.
Excellent. If you ever get stuck in a kind of place like you have to rest for 3 months or something like that, watching the entire Babylon 5 series is an enlightenment. We were talking about it on a earlier show that I played earlier. Great series, really, really recommended. And it's not like government sponsored. This is like, there's some real stuff in there. Really high stuff.
Well, that happened to me when I was writing my first book on psychopaths. I was watching Battlestar Galactica, and in very in-depth, like went through all the DVDs and all the box sets. And it was amazing how it was synchronistically tying in my work on psychopaths, because that's exactly what the Cylons were. And also my interest in transhumanism as well. And it was this spooky synchronicity that tied in with my work at the time. So it's you know, this is why culture is so important, even popular culture, because it gives us almost like a navigation beacon of where we are and where we're going.
Absolutely. You know, I've ever since I was a kid, I've always felt much more aligned to sci-fi than I do to the news, for instance. A lot of people are really addicted to the news, and unless it's on the news, they will not accept it as being real.
And well, you know why that is?
Why?
Honestly, God, there's an actual neurological reason for that. In my last book, The Animal of the Psyche, I talk about it. We're actually medicated by the news. The people who have to watch this, you know, like we have when people, we don't do it anymore, but you have friends who watch the news 3 times a day, and they're usually the same 3 stories. What's happening to them is they're actually being medicated. When the news story first comes on, you get that dum dum dum. You know, you always have those kind of like soundtrack musics. You get this rush of adrenaline. It subconsciously, you actually believe you're in danger, and you have norepinephrine, the stress hormone, firing up from your lower brainstem, and so you're put in a state of hypervigilance. Even though you're not aware of it, and you're just sitting there having a cup of tea in your hand, you're still put under a state of hypervigilance. And this is why and what happens is you're getting a kind of an adrenaline rush that also you're hoping that the news anchor is going to deliver the panacea that's going to switch it off. And they always do, because the last story on the news broadcast is always the cutesy sort of human interest story, and the anchor or whatever, the newsreader, leaves us with a smile. And what happens then is you do get your relief from your hypervigilance, and you get a small rush of dopamine in the frontal cortex of your brain. And that's what they keep people addicted with. And that's what makes the subliminal programming of the news reach and target people so effectively, is they're actually being neurologically changed and altered, actually being made junkies, you know, by being doped up 3 times a day by watching the news. And it's almost like they're drug dealer, and they will not betray their drug dealer because he or she provides them with the dopamine. And this is why they give night votes to like Trevor MacDonald and pay, you know, TV anchors enormous salaries. And this is why they would call people like Peter Jennings in the United States the most trusted man in America, even though he was just a talking head who read a sheet of paper. Walter Cronkite was the same as well, another one.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. So the news, now we're discovering that particularly seems to be CNN that gets busted on this, is that their journalists have found, you know, we saw this in one of the Iraq wars, which is a couple of years ago, that they weren't really reporting from the battlefield or a hotel near the battlefield. They were reporting from somewhere in America. And that they're in some just random hotel with some palm trees and palm plants, and they faked it. And then we find that the people who appear to be witnesses of these false flag, of these big shooting events and 9/11s and things like that, are the same people. Even to the point of there's this one woman, and I've seen this video, it's brilliant. There's this woman who's like really worried and sort of, what was you? Oh, it was terrible. And then she, oh yes, I remember that. Another shooting and she's a different character. They play all these different characters, including like a university professor. This same woman who was playing a kind of housewife plays a university professor from Iran, you know, and it's stunning. And then there's others that go to even extremes. I don't know if you've seen these, that they say it's like it's the Rothschild family themselves who are playing these parts. But I don't know if that's really true.
Well, CNN has been busted for years, and it's amazing that they still get away with it. But their ratings are horrific. If you look at their ratings, it's terrible for considering like the reach and you know the market reach that they have. I think like they're down to a couple of 100,000 listeners in the United, viewers in the United States, which is atrocious considering the access to the market they have. But back in the '90s during Gulf War One, they had, you know, reporters in an obvious studio. And there's some great videos on YouTube pretending that they're actually in Basra, waiting for missiles to come in from Saddam Hussein. And it's just the most stupid piece of ham acting in a ham studio set you've ever seen.
Seen,
and it's just incredible. And they're still, CNN is atrocious. I mean, it's just a bizarre place in general. You know, I used to live in Atlanta, and it's just a weird whole setup anyway. And there's no way Ted Turner has made that kind of wealth and built that influence up on actual advertising money. He's working for somebody.
So. News less reliable than sci-fi. When you go and watch a film, what's the sort of do you go for the documentary kind of films when you go out?
Well, I don't go to the cinema. I haven't been to the cinema in years. What kind of films do I watch? You're gonna laugh at this one. I love old horror films. I love old Hammer films. The old Hammer British films. I love the old Hammer sci-fi films. The Quatermass films. I have a huge collection of horror and all horror and all sci-fi, and I love 1970s Hollywood movies, the golden age of Hollywood, where you had really good storylines, superb actors, and brilliant directors. You know, films like the Deer Hunter, Deliverance, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Dog Day Afternoon, Midnight Cowboy, The Shining. You know, there were so many fantastic films made in America, in Hollywood, in the 70s. And they're the kind of films I love, along with really well-made British old films. I think the most recent film I watched that I really liked was probably The Hobbit.
Yeah, well, the Quatermass movies it's interesting, just to nip back to the Blake 7 thing we were talking about. One of the things about Blake 7 is it has a tradition of British sci-fi, which has this... British sci-fi stems out of Doctor Who, right? We started off with Doctor Who, we had the Tomorrow People, and these... the sets were really cardboardy, and they were very obviously cardboardy. It's like they didn't really care very much about the sets. It was the characters and the quality of the acting. Where I think on the other side of the pond, it was more of the whiz bang. You know, how many bright lights, blue lights can we put in your face?
And yeah, it's a bit of tail.
Yeah. So, this idea of a kind of, it's almost like a pantomime. You know what I mean? And I've often thought, you know, maybe I should write. I've thought about writing a Doctor Who episode. I've got a great idea for a Doctor Who episode that involves planetary collisions and Moses and things. It's great.
That sounds good. British sci-fi also tended to be nihilistic, where American sci-fi was tend to be sort of like endorsing the American dream that the cowboy John Wayne figure rides in at the end and saves the day. British sci-fi generally was nihilistic, which is what made it so, look at the Quatermass movies, which was what made it so believable.
Yeah, because Britain is dark and depressing, I have to say, at various times, you know, when
especially in the 70s and 60s, especially in the 70s, it was.
Yeah. There was this, and this is something that I really noticed, that there was an expression of technology at the time, and probably in the Black Projects they must have gotten some stuff and really made some great discoveries, because suddenly there was a splurge of quite sophisticated and very usable technologies that made themselves apparent in the 70s. You know, previous to the 70s, videotape was these massive reels, and it was difficult to do that. And then in the 70s, we had the cassette, and the vinyl has been going, and all these different and wooden stereos. You know, wooden boxes for your stereo and things like that. And there was a sense of warmth that just hasn't been since then. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
There was
coldness.
Mm.
Detachment from, like, you're right, the stereo systems, the old record players, even the old, like, you know, those old big old radios that had, like, you see Luxembourg and Athlone and Berlin written on the dial.
Oh, yes.
They had big valve tubes inside them that glowed, and you could literally cook toast on them. So there was actually heat produced from the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And the sound was lovely and warm, you know? And it's like, now we've gone to like MP3 players where the sound is kind of cold and the machine itself is cold. It's like a pill.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a pill rather than a meal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a very good analogy. It's exactly what it's like.
Interesting. So, yeah. And I've always had this feeling, and probably because it was my teen years, right? I mean, I'm very aware that, you know, I see things from my own point of view, and it's not the same as everybody else's point of view. Many people try to tell me that fact, you know, my point of view is very unusual, or words to that effect. But I really feel that the music that came out of that time, there was a sense of, there was a burst of creativity that somehow has been, it was wiped over. It was, you know, somebody spoilt the party, you know.
Big time. And there's still good bands and good singers and good performers, but the whole system is geared to not, so they don't get mainstream exposure.
So did you, when you were growing up, did you have that idea that you were going to be a musician and you'd make it big, like, who was getting big at the time you were growing up?
Who was getting big at those? Well, I'm just trying to think. At the time I got really serious about it, I guess it was the punk rock years, so even Sex Pistols, The Damned, and then the sort of new wave of British heavy metal came along, like the Iron Maidens and the bands like that. I honestly never thought about making it big. Honestly, I would have been happy just to have played small pubs and stuff. I didn't even think about fame. In fact, one of the things I did was I was in a band that were on the verge of signing a major deal, and I left because I didn't feel like I was up for it. So I kind of walked away from fame. I just didn't want it. Maybe I did. I mean, it'd be nice to have the money and stuff, but I was kind of happy in my life in other ways. I was just happy just to play with a band, even in a rehearsal studio. I just wanted to make sound. That's all I ever really wanted. And to make records, which I did. And so that's all I ever wanted. And I got it. I mean, I achieved my ambition. So, I mean, I played CBGBs in New York, and that was, to me, was the ultimate. And I got there before I was 20. So I can't complain, you know?
It's funny that you're saying this. because I almost had the same expression about, you know, I don't want to be involved with all that stuff. And I was in a band that was doing all right. Well, I mean, it wasn't doing hugely, but I just felt it would start taking over my life and that's all I would be doing. And that thought kind of, the thought of that thought, hang on, no, I'll do much more than just doing this music stuff. You know, I'm much more than that. I've got to do something else. So I stepped away from that.
It's also very hard work. People who've never been in a band don't understand what very hard work it is. You know, that song by Dire Straits, Money for Nothing, that was Martin Roffler really saying, you know, these two guys were thinking that people are in bands, they get money for nothing, but there's years of hard work, and then there's very, very hard work while it's going on.
So, while we're talking about and music and bands, they're talking about Doctor Who, which is another subject very close to my heart. And one of them, King, is saying, am I the only person who feels like they're turning the Doctor into a psychopath?
Well, someone said that to me recently on my Facebook page. Said, I haven't watched Doctor Who since David Tennant was on it. And I just lost interest after that. I don't have a TV, so I can't watch it anyway. But someone was saying to me that element of psychopathology seems to be creeping into the character more and more.
Well, he seems to be, he's got a troubled past. He's got this massive guilt thing that probably going to, you know, all come together in the sort of some grand finale. Dinosaurs on a spaceship. One psychopath per TARDIS, don't you think? All right, his wife called him a psychopath. Maybe she thinks she's a psych. She's a psychopath. She's the one who goes around killing people, isn't it? His wife, the very gorgeous woman with the lovely voice. You haven't seen that one? River Song is her name.
I haven't seen Doctor Who in probably 10 years.
All right. All right, so we won't talk about Doctor Who. Okay, but anyway, my vote is
I think I had the classic one back in the 70s. I mean, I like John Pertwee and I liked Tom Baker and I like David Tennant, but to me the show has always been very actor-focused. For me, I think the show is only as good as the actor they can stick inside of the TARDIS. For me personally, anyway.
My vote is for Daniel Radcliffe because the Doctor's... He started out as an old guy and he's gotten younger and younger and younger. And the guy who played Harry Potter, I think, should be the next Doctor. He's just ideal. That's my own opinion, you know. I don't mind.
It'd be kind of cool to have a female Doctor, wouldn't it?
Ooh. Well, yeah, there was... there have been times when he gets cloned and the DNA goes... There is a female version of him sort of riding around somewhere randomly. That's another interesting thing that they dropped in a couple of series back. Meanwhile, so where are we? We're here at Ever Beyond, and I'm speaking tonight with Thomas Sheridan of thomassheridanarts.com.
Yep.
Yeah, excellent. You have your paintings there, and some of your music, and your writings, and your books. I follow you on Facebook, you know, we post things, and I'm always interested to, you know, sometimes you drop a couple of one-liners, a bit of comedy, and sometimes you'll write something about what's going on in the moment, you know, how you're seeing this consciousness unfold. So do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, what you're seeing at the moment, Thomas?
You mean in general?
Yes, in the world.
Human collective consciousness experience.
Yeah.
I'm seeing an awful lot of confusion. I'm seeing an awful lot of almost like a disheartened loss of faith in this control structure, which is a good thing because we have to make the control structure die. I can see that people... I look at a lot of mainstream boards, especially here in Ireland, the mainstream topic boards are good to look at because Irish people tend to be very conservative. I don't mean in a religious sense or a political sense, but they tend to not, get too hysterical about anything. It's generally easy as it goes kind of thing. And I can sense a lot here, but I'm seeing it in other countries too, because I travel a bit, that people are fed up with the world that's being handed to them. But they're not quite sure what they want to replace it with. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So we're kind of going through a consciousness adolescence right now, where people are getting the consciousness version of growing pains and acne and, all the other things. And it's at the stage now where, when you have like a young, a huffy teenager who's like, you want to go to the pictures? Eh. You want to go to see a football game? Eh. Want to go for a walk? You know, that kind of attitude that teenagers get at that age. We've all done it. Well, I think the human the Western consciousness at the moment is in that kind of stage. It doesn't like what's happening. It doesn't really understand where it's coming from, and it doesn't know where it's going. So we're in a kind of an adolescence sort of like stuck up phase in human consciousness at the moment. Something's coming down the road. I think the internet's playing an enormous part in that. However, having said that, I don't believe personally in this idea there's going to be a consciousness breakthrough. A consciousness shift where everyone shifts. I think it's an individual thing. I think some people will choose to evolve, and I don't mean to say that in an elitist or a sort of a better than others wake, but evolve their consciousness to the point where they're not getting anything from this reality, from this structure. So they'll shift over, they'll break through actually, over to something that can be more attuned to the kind of life they want to live rather than the one that's imposed upon them. And I'm definitely seeing a lot more of that kind of thing. In a couple of weeks, I've been asked to address a psychotherapist's council group in Ireland. This is mainstream, it's big stuff. When we talk to a lot of psychotherapists here, which is, I was very surprised they invited me to ask to address to give them a presentation. What I'm hearing is amazing. The guy that arranged the seminar is telling me that he's getting more and more calls and having more and more discussions with psychiatrists and psychologists who would have a middle-aged man or woman, a professional, an accountant, an actuary, an engineer, an advertising designer, whatever, walking into their office and saying, I think there's something wrong with me. And the doctor would say, what's wrong with you? He said, I think I'm going nuts. And they'd say, why do you think I'm going nuts? And he says, I don't care about my career. I don't care about anything. All I want to do is do things like watch sunsets.
Nothing wrong with that at all.
Yeah, and to their credit, the mental health professionals know these guys and these women are not nuts, but they don't know how to treat them. And so they're aware that there's a shift going on. The old ways are gone. Lots of people are kind of having a kind of a consciousness midlife crisis or a conscious adolescence. So they're desperately, to their credit, looking for people that can actually help them deal with their patients, because they don't want to give them drugs because they're not sick and they're not psychotic. So they've asked people like me to come in and help explain to them what this consciousness stuff is, how it works, and so on. So I'm very honored and excited that I was asked to do that, mainly because it's one more proof that the breakthrough is absolutely happening and the tide is starting to roll back in again.
That's superb, Thomas. That's really good news for you.
Yeah. I'm really good about it, actually.
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of respect given, when a bunch of psychiatrists, when a bunch of professionals asks somebody who's done independent research without any qualifications or
PhD. Yeah, you know how it happened? Last year I was attacked by a cult, this crazy cult, and they started posting all kind of nutty things on the internet and vicious things about me all over the internet. And one guy who was in Ireland who was a psychologist who was doing work on cults was just searching around the internet and stumbled upon this bunch of maniacs and couldn't believe what he was seeing. And so it was my reaction to them, which was basically to not do anything. I shut up and I basically hid for a while. And he observed and monitored and recorded the dynamics of these crazies and how they behaved for his own research going forward. And he contacted me eventually and said, I was very impressed with how you handled that. This is a lot of people would have buckled under the pressure. And I explained to him, well, I've written 2 books on psychopaths. And he says, yeah, I read them both and they're excellent. And I said, and then you know that my attitude is whenever you're tackled by a psychopathic or a pathological structure or individual, that you actually throw up a wall and you refuse to engage. The rules of engagement with a toxic entity or individual is non-engagement. And so that's how it came out of that. So it was just this amazing sort of happenstance of circumstances. And it's all come together. So out of, you know, lemons came lemonade.
That's fantastic. See, and because I suppose, you know, in a way, you know, the universe or your own higher self is giving you a test of your own theories there, it sounds like.
Oh, absolutely. And also a lot of people who are sort of like involved in occult and esoteric fields, who are like good people who contact me, who I'm in contact with, said to me, this was your call to the big time, because you don't get anything, you don't move to the next level without some kind of vicious attack. And it's really the universe saying, are you ready to take the next step? So apparently I was, and I'm not saying it was easy. It was, you know, to have your family viciously attacked by these mindless thugs and then sneaking onto your Facebook page and getting information on your friends and everything. I mean, these kinds of groups are incredibly sick. And in the end, it worked out, because it was basically, it had vast numbers of people in very high positions actually watching them, which they didn't expect, and I think quite frightened them, because they just thought it was going to be an internet thing. So, and it actually gave me a boost with the mainstream, which I wasn't expecting.
So, your name is coming around. You've got a very similar name to a Scottish politician, which is, you know, often it's a bit weird. You know, I've got Thomas Sheridan. Tommy Sheridan. No, Thomas Sheridan.
Let me tell you what happened. There was a very funny story that happened with that. When I first started doing interviews about 2 years ago, I was on an Irish radio station, and then about 6 months later, the producer of the station called up and said, please don't sue us. And I was like, what? And it says, Thomas, we had a guest on the show, and it's only right you know about it, that said some very scathing things about you. And it says, what? I called you a con artist and everything, and this, that, and the other. And I says, and who was it? And they named the guy, and the guy I actually knew. And I said, he would not have said that about me. And what happened was, he was talking about the Scottish politician, Tom Sheridan, and the producer of the radio show, who didn't know about me, thought that they were talking about me. Ah. And so they were worried that I was going to sue them for stuff that he was saying about a public figure. And it was quite a funny in the end, but that's actually how I got to become aware of this politician in Scotland.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's like, you know, I don't know how it is, but the Scottish politicians just seem to be more raw, and they're very honest, and they seem to portray where they're coming from quite directly, you know. I'm thinking about Alex Salmond and, you know, George Galloway, and, you know, very outspoken and very definite. Tommy.
Yeah, I don't know anything about the man. I'm just saying this is what was said about him. Apparently he's had a few scandals connected to him, but then again, you don't know how much truth there is to that either.
From what I hear personally, there's a bit of truth to that, you know. But, you know, he's a politician. They're all bought and sold, you know. What can you do? Yeah. This is part of the future that we're cutting out. The part of the future that we're working around and trying to create a new one of. We're coming up to a break in a few minutes, and maybe we'll talk about stuff like that in terms of, you know, how we can move forward, and ideas that you've got. You know, what would, how would you like to live your life, and that kind of thing. I'd like to discuss that in the next hour. So you're seeing a lot of slow movements in consciousness. Some people are waking up, aren't they?
Yeah, and some people are exploding into waking up, which is they have to watch themselves and put the brakes on it, because there's no end of predators out there who will actually try to manipulate them into their way of thinking. I'm talking about cults and things like that, or even there's, like, I had it on my show tonight, The Velocity of Now. We had a very good discussion about how the intelligence services are now flooding the alternative movement with spies and shills and moles who are actually there to derail people who are waking up. So I think when people, there's some people waking up very fast, they have to put the brakes on and be a bit more critical thinking. I see it on Facebook a lot. Now, it's good to wake up, but like, some people are seeing conspiracies everywhere, or seeing, are to be, and, it's, and I look at the origin of many of these memes that they share that, like, don't make them look particularly well in front of their peers and maybe their family members who are not woken up. I have a video on my website, on my YouTube channel, called How to Wake Up Without Losing Friends. And people should really watch that, because people need to wake up slowly now and not explode. So I know it's hard to do. And then others who are waking up too slowly need to get the pedal to the metal and be a bit more brave and be a bit more assertive of their views.
I think it's part of the problem with waking up. And this is, I have a dear friend. He comes round to my house, and he's managed to alienate just about everybody I know, because he'll be talking about it and talking about it and really going on about it, and it's getting too intense for him, because at that stage that he was, he didn't realize there was things you could do about it. And he's just in that, oh my God, kind of phase. This is what they're doing. And it can be, it's like trying to swallow something bigger than your head, isn't it?
Oh yeah. And that's, I think a lot of that stuff is pushed out there to make fellas and women like your friend make that mistake and shoot their mouths off and alienate themselves from others. I know quite a few decent people have done that. They've woken up much too fast, and it's been like, it's like their eyelids have been ripped off, and then they can't put their mouth in gear. They're constantly blabbering about, you know, this, that, and the other. And they may be talking about things that later on they would regret. You know, sort of like the more sort of outlandish conspiracy theory stuff that you could just don't say to people who are not woken up. But that's part of the process too. You know, we learn from our mistakes. There's no evolution from success. Evolution comes from failure. Because when you fail, you learn how to do it better next time. So maybe that's part of the process too. You know, Jay,
I think so. I think so, because, I mean, there are so many traps on the way to enlightenment. You know, there are so many potholes on the road. And one of the potholes is the pothole of discernment. Of, you know, you're walking along and there's this guy on the side and he's saying, oh, yeah, yeah, blah, 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 truth, blah, 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 true, true, truth. And then, you know, you think, oh, that sounds interesting. And it's like the first book you come to in the bookshop, you take it home and read it. You know, it's a little too open. But the problem is that there are few trustable guides. And what we're trying to do is find our own inner trust. And it's a kind of dichotomy. You know, how do you find a teacher who's going to teach you just enough and then let you go out into the world, make your own choices, and make your own mistakes?
Exactly. And this is a big thing too as well. A lot of people, when they go to that stage of suddenly waking up, are looking for gurus to give them the answer. And what they fail to understand at that point, although they do discover it in time, is what James Joyce called the monomyth. James Joyce wrote an amazing book called Ulysses about the life of one man in one day in 1904. And it was just the life of an ordinary advertising exec, a salesman in a newspaper. But his whole day, put in the context of his life, was a monomyth, in that he had to be a hero, a villain, a lover, a betrayer, a fool, and a genius, an atheist, a spiritual person, a saint, and a sinner. In the course of one ordinary man's life day, was an enormous act of heroic pursuit, because he was dealing with a wife who was having sex behind us with other men while he was at work, and he was dealing with the loss of his infant child. And then when you put in that context of the monomyth, then you come around to the same idea of the labyrinth and of the hero. The only hero you need in the end, and the only guru you need in the end, is yourself. And when you discover that, you have your teachers, you have those who inspire you, but that's all they do for a while. When you find that, when you stumble upon the absolute reality that this is your monomyth, that you are the hero in your own story, that you are Prometheus who still stole the fire from the gods, that you are Orpheus in the underworld, and you start to realize that this vast canon of mythology, right up until today, from ancient times right to today, is talking about you as an individual, then you've truly and completely woken up.
And with that, perfect. You finished exactly on the hour of midnight.
Wow.
On that last word. So with that, I'm gonna play Peter Green. You remember Peter Green from Fleetwood Mac?
Yeah, and your guitar player reminds me of him.
Thank you. He is definitely one of my guitar influences.
And I can definitely hear that.
I'll tell you about that. This is Big Change Is Gonna Come. And welcome back to Ever Beyond. Tonight, I'm speaking with Thomas Sheridan from Sligo, near Dublin. Is that correct?
No, it's about 100 miles, only 25 miles from Dublin.
Oh, really? Oh, I thought it was...
It's outside the country. No. I'm from Dublin originally, but Sligo is about 100-odd miles from Dublin and from Belfast. If you drew a line from Belfast and Dublin heading west, they would converge on Sligo.
Ah, right. So you're on the west coast of Ireland.
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful here, yeah.
Lovely. I went... In the early 80s, I spent 4 days, and it doesn't sound much, but time has a different quality in the west coast of Southern Ireland, doesn't it? I was in place called Connemara.
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful, yeah.
So, I said I'll be back. I haven't been back yet. But, I ended up in Scotland, and it's got that same... it's just lovely. I mean, where I stay is just gorgeous. It's on the other side of the valley from Pluscarden Abbey in Elgin, and
where's Elgin now? I'm trying to think.
Okay, so if you imagine Britain, and you're looking at Britain, and as if it's like a guy who's sitting down with his feet pointing west. Then if you go up to the head has got this funny kind of wedge-shaped thing missing from it, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah? At the south coast of that, that's Murray. That's and I'm about one-third of the way along from the east end. The east end is Inverness.
Oh, okay. So you're on that Inverness-Aberdeen...
That's right.
...side. I know that area well, yeah.
Yeah. So Elgin is...
That looks very much like this part of Ireland, actually.
Yeah, yeah. So I always get that feeling when I hear the shows. I get a feeling that you're in a similar kind of energy to me situation. And
Scotland, and the west coast of Ireland are very similar. Where the east coast of Ireland and like Dublin and London are very similar.
Hmm.
You know that kind of thing. There's the same kind of energy. That's why I have a hard time surviving in big cities now. I get tired very quickly.
I understand completely. there's you know, there's a certain sensitivity that comes with being able to tune in, like with when you're playing music, you tune into other people, on or you're tuning into certain images that you're creating or whatever. And that makes it difficult to be around other people, because once you start to tune in, you realize that people are broadcasting so loudly that you have to kind of get away from them. Do you find that, Thomas?
Yeah, sensory overload. Even like when I go to Dublin, it's awful. Now, I grew up in Dublin, and I love the city, and there's so much, you know, great things about it too. But the advertising on the buses and the trams flying by, you know, the constant lighting in the shop windows, the sensory overload is in a different energetic level. And I used to thrive on that, but now it makes me very, very tired. And yeah, it's not because I'm aging, because when I got back home here, I jumped out into in the village I'm in, I jumped out of the car and I was actually dancing across the square. So it was because the energy here feeds me where, at this stage of my life, where the energy in a large urban area zaps me.
Exactly the same. You know, there's a feeling. Actually, when I grew up, my dad was a country boy. He was a Canadian, and he grew up in the Canadian woods, and so the city never really suited me. And you know, I got out of the city in the late 80s, early 90s, and even in the 80s, I tried to live a kind of countrified lifestyle, sort of a little bit slower than the rest of the city, but it just eventually, it was like, you know, you're on a roundabout and you've got to jump off at a point when it's not going to be so fast that you're going to break a leg as you come off, but it's got to be fast enough that, you know, just really, you know that it's definitely going to go turn into a bad situation in the future. You know, is it?
That must have been some culture shock for your dad to go from the Canadian backwoods to Bethnal Green.
Holy Lord, yes. Yes. But he lived a kind of he lived a country village life.
Right.
We discovered, you know, he after he died, right, in the early 90s, after he died, we discovered that he had all these little this group of people that he would go and see in the morning. While we were all asleep, he got up really early and would go to the shop and buy the paper for several people and go round and deliver it every day. We never knew. Nobody knew until
the... That's sweet.
That's the beautiful thing. You know, it's just posthumous. I love him more and more and more.
He stayed a country boy in his heart.
That's right. That's right. I mean, he was never very sophisticated. Not like us kids getting into technology.
Also, I'd imagine the East End of London was probably a close-knit community in the 60s anyway. It wouldn't have been as sort of like nihilistic as cities are today.
Yeah. My mother's parents ran a sweet shop, which is still there, which still bears their name, even though it's run by Bengalis. They kept the name because it says Goodman. You know, his name was Goodman, and they had this shop. So we always had this connection with the community by having that little shop, where my grandfather was a sugar and tobacco and propaganda dealer. Otherwise known as a tobacconist. oh yeah, what a life. Anyway, sorry, just talking about my stuff. When you actually, what kind of kid were you, Thomas?
Shy, introverted, very sensitive. Like, I mean, really sensitive. Like, I used to get very upset by TV shows and stuff like that, like Lassie or Animal Disney. I used to be traumatized by Disney cartoons. I was very, 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 actually looking back on it now, much, much too sensitive for a kid on the north side of Dublin.
Totally, totally.
Much too sensitive. I wasn't bullied. I have to say I wasn't bullied, mainly because I was people didn't know I existed.
you tried the invisibility trick, did you?
Yeah, well, you know, it's this weird thing. I can remember, we'd be in a class, we'd be like, you know, when I was younger, going to like from one year to the next year in primary school, and it'd be a couple of weeks before a teacher would notice, who are you? I was like really good at being low profile. But then I really came out of my shell in secondary school. It went really well for me. I had a lovely time in secondary school. I had lots of friends, and I just had lots of good experiences. But as a young kid, very, very quiet, very introspective, not like an outgoing kid at all. I mean, I'm one of those kids. You know, not one of those kids that just doesn't talk. I was one of them. But there was a lot going on in my brain. I had a phenomenal imagination. I still do.
Beware of the quiet ones, I always used to say. So yeah, so you know, in that crucible, and Dublin, Dublin, early 70s, mid 70s.
Well, I was born in Dublin in the mid 60s. Then I went to Liverpool for a while, and then, because I'm coming from my family background is Liverpool Irish kind of mixed, and then went back to Dublin, north inner city, and that would have been mid 70s. I can remember like when I started getting into music about 8 or 9, it was Bowie and things like that. I remember like Life on Mars by David Bowie was the first record I bought. I was 9, which is like, I'm still quite proud of that. It wasn't Donny Osmond or something like that. Nothing against Donny Osmond. I mean, I'm just saying I was kind of like, it's pretty amazed that was the first song that really appealed to me. But, this has been like mid to late 70s.
Love that song. Actually, my song of the week, you know, I don't know if you get this, but I sometimes get a song that stays in my head for a few days. They call it in Germany an earworm. I don't know what everything about that. But this week has been Starman. Exactly. Brilliant. It's been deconstructing itself in my head. You know, I hear like a little riff over and over and over again while I was sitting in the shower, and it's like, oh, or standing in the shower. You know, I don't sit in the shower. That's weird. Anyway, I get these kind of mental loops that go on, and I don't even know how the song goes. I just get these little bits, and it forces me to go to the.
It's a very strange song.
It is.
It's musically very odd and dissonant and complex.
Yeah.
Well, and that's why I can't remember it either. Like when he's singing the verses, there's all kinds of guitar and rhythms going on in the background that don't seem to match the flow of the song. And then it has these kind of crooner breaks, da 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 da, da, and then it goes in the di 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 di, and then this kind of big kind of almost Las Vegas chorus. It's a very strange song, but it's brilliant in that way.
It is indeed. There's a star man. Maybe I'll play that after the end of the show tonight. Do you get these earworms? Do you get earworms?
Oh God, yeah. And they're always songs I hate. I don't know what that's about. Don't even get me going. There's one song that was on the chart. Maybe your listeners know about it. But every time I went into the supermarket anywhere in Ireland, I heard this stupid song that went, tonight's gonna be a good night, and tonight's gonna be a good night. And then it goes to this chorus where, I got my money, I'm gonna spend it, which is obviously NLP for the supermarkets, right?
Yeah, right.
This thing was in my head like cancer. I could not get rid of it. It was a musical tumor, not an earworm.
tumor.
And it was driving me mental. And it's like now become my kind of, I know it offends Danny, listens might like it, my benchmark for rotten music. I thought it was the name of the song, and I hope I never find out. I don't want to hear it again. But this thing embedded itself in my consciousness like a musical STD or something.
It's like musical herpes. So
horrible.
Yeah, but this is the thing, and now, okay, so let's just go on to the subject of hit records and psychopaths, because the, you know, there's this ever since you know, for ever since that era, there was this velo, and he came up in lots of different forms, and he had all these different names, and he always had these hit records. And they were terrible. The man I'm talking about is Jonathan King. Do you remember Jonathan King?
Oh God.
Right?
I remember as a kid, he had this song called, I don't mean to pollute your consciousness, but it was like, one for me, one for you. And he was wearing this multicolored kind of Afro wig with two chicks on either side of them wearing this multicolored Afro wig. And I was, as a kid, watching that, and I was saying, what in the name of Jesus is that? How did he get on television? It was like a Father Ted moment. And I was like, even then, I was like, there's something seriously wrong with the world that guy there has hit records looking and dressing like that. And then it turns out that he's like this massive like sex criminal who had like put like young guys through absolute hell. He was the original star of the BBC sex killer pedophile ring, you know.
But, exactly.
He was the Mac Daddy of the nonsense at the BBC. He was the first one to go down. And I remember when this bastard went down, he said something like, "In years to come, I'll be seen the same way as Oscar Wilde." And that just shows you right then. He had that smirk, that psychopathic smirk. I don't know, what is he still in prison, that piece of crap?
I actually don't know whether he's been vaporized, which he should have been. But yeah, he had this funny face, didn't he? He had two faces. He had a face that had a smile, and there was a face that didn't have a smile.
Oh,
like a,
yeah.
Cyberman.
Exactly. And he had this sort of self-satisfied smugness about him, which so many of them have.
Yeah.
And a spectacular lack of talent.
Exactly. And he, now we realize how he got to be the hit maker that he is. Right? It's nothing to do with talent. It's whether you're a satanic pedophile or not.
Well, the BBC back then was a nest of them.
Back then?
Not to say they were all like that. I met Kid Jensen and he was a lovely fella. I don't think he was one of the Canadian guys.
Mm-hmm, he must have thought, Jesus, what am I in?
He was one of these fellas who genuinely cared about music. You could see that. So that was the marker for me. Where the rest of them were just like, on my website, I've done a report on Jimmy Savile. I actually believe that Jimmy Savile was actually a co-murderer with Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper.
You know, it's likely that not only that, but he was involved with the Moors murders, and that the Moors murders were basically a dumping ground for the product of the satanic rituals that they did.
Well, it's amazing you mentioned that, because on my website I have a thing called "Did Jimmy Savile Model His Image on Moira Hindley?" And I show a photograph of Jimmy Savile in 1965, and he has black curly hair. And in 1967, following the 66 high-profile trial of the Moors murderers, he has the same exact haircut as Moira Hindley.
Oh, shades of Twin Peaks.
And dyed blonde. I don't know. I've never seen Twin Peaks. And dyed blonde. So they've only let out the tip of the iceberg of the Jimmy Savile story. Jimmy Savile, I call him the 666 killer, because all the murders took place along a corridor, the M6, I think the M62 and the M61. And I have a map on my website which showed that he could have easily committed these crimes, went back to his quote unquote altar in Leeds, and then scarpered up, I think, I can't remember the number, it was an A road, up through York, up to Scarborough, where he kept a shrine to his mother of all her clothes, which he called the Duchess. And also further up that road to Sunderland, where the fake tapes and the fake letters were mailed from. Jimmy Savile, I actually believe that Sutcliffe may not have actually been the main killer. In fact, in David Yelop's book, In Pure Evil, he mentions that at the time, this book was written just after Sutcliffe was prosecuted for the killings, that there was another killer at large that had a gap in his tooth and then had very expensive dental work done to hide the gap, and that was Savile.
So it turns out that he's not only he's got lots of talents. He's not only a DJ, and he did loads for charity. They would always say, "Oh, but look at the charity he did! What a cover! What a great cover!" Anyway, that he was a procurer of children for the elite parties, and presumably he would he was a dance hall owner. And he would be connected with all the underground lords of, if anybody wanted anything, cocaine or heroin or marijuana or anything, he'd probably get it. And probably, that extended into, women and men and boys and girls and children and, corpses and
dead bodies.
Yeah.
And on top of that, I mean, you and I know how big a star he was. The money he must have been raking in between Jim Will Fix It, which was the number one rated TV show, a regular host on Top of the Pops, at the same time he was the spokesperson for British Rail, and then doing all his other gigs on the side. He must have been raking it in.
Well, not only that, but he must have been paid pretty well for all the procurement.
Yeah.
So that had to go somewhere. You know, he had loads of Rolls Royces. I don't know if he was like that rich because of the that or because of the procurement. But yeah. Anyway, so there's these two people, and they were really big in the day. They were like the hit people. They made vast numbers of sales of music and had all this power and influence. And now it turns out that actually the real power was the corrupt power that they had as part of the government paedophile ring.
Yeah, and I always wonder why, what was his name, King went down. I wonder did he piss, well, he was obviously more directly psychopathic. Did he, what's the word, piss off somebody by getting a little bit too arrogant and full of himself? It's
possibly
interesting how he went down first and so long ago.
I think they needed to have a sacrificial lamb.
Yeah.
Because things were starting to leak. Now this leak has, the dam has burst.
The BBC should have really been shut down.
Hmm.
If that was a private business anywhere else, it would have actually lost its operating license.
Yeah, well,
it's just amazing.
Sorry.
The BBC is allowed to actually function, you know, still.
Well, because we also discover that the BBC is involved in the false flag terrorist activity all over the world, that it's actually complicit to a great degree in distributing of the raw information that gets fed to all the news networks. It's like the AP of TV. And so if the BBC reports something, it's spread all over the world without question. And on 9/11, that respect was played to its full, but they made a big mistake. Now, whether that was somebody on the light side, just giving putting that sheet in the wrong order, this is the scheduled for 20 minutes later, or whether it was the newsreader, or whether it was a complete mistake and a total cock-up that caused the woman newsreader to read out the fact that the building behind her had just collapsed, where it was just standing. You've seen this piece, haven't you?
Yeah, it's staggering. It's inexplicable in every single way.
Exactly. So, I mean, one can say that could be like what they call white hat, a white hat operative in there, just making that little cock up, or it could be their psychopathy expressing itself, you know, as the part of the...
Yeah, it could be the calming card too. Yeah. This occult thing is all about letting you know what they've done. You know, this kind of weird sort of psychopathic, occult, satanic nature that they all have going on in their kind of magic. And it's to let us know, to almost like laugh at us. They don't believe their magic works unless they... what's the word?
Informed.
Unless they, we know about it. We have to be made aware of it.
Yeah, we have to be willing.
I wonder if that's it.
So, you know, King falls on as James in the chat room said. Someone will always fall on their sword for their supreme ruler. You know, was Jimmy Savile? You know, but the thing is, the question that I have now, right? So we've now seen Jimmy Savile, and then we saw Ted Heath, who was the prime minister during that time, and all of those things. And now we're coming up. Have you heard of Holly Gregg?
I heard this story, but I don't know what to make of it. I don't know if I believe it or not. I'm aware of the story. I've looked into it. And I don't know what to say, to be honest with you. It's just that I mean, it seems plausible on some levels, but on other levels, it just seems like I can't fully grasp the integrity of the people making the accusations completely.
Right.
I'll just say for now I'm neutral about it.
Well, I did a bit of research into it because it's local. It's Aberdeen, just like a couple of hours away. My best mate actually grew up in that area. So I've got this kind of... Anyway, but what I've discovered is that the procurer who would procure for the parties up here, because Aberdeen is a place where they have big oil and they have big parties.
Yeah.
And so they need a procurer. And it turns out there are various other parties that have parties around here that involve people like the social worker chief and the medical chief and the newspaper chief and all that stuff. Anyway, that has a connection with Thomas Hamilton, the guy who did the shoot up at Dunblane. And then it all drops into place that the kids that he shot at Dunblane were the children that were passed around this ring, and this ring connected with Gordon Brown, who has been so compromised in that he sold half of Britain's gold for a dead cheap price to do a favor for the people who own him.
Wow.
That's my connection.
Wow, that is incredible. That is a bombshell. And so he basically is so owned, so compromised, you think he sold off this gold on the cheap.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's the thing that all the financial analysts said, no man in his right mind would do this, only an insane mind. But Gordon Brown is not insane. He's dull, he's boring, he may be he wouldn't be foolish like that, fiscally. You know, he's really fiscally, you know, he's uptight fiscally, you know. Wouldn't do that. If he had his druthers about it, he wouldn't be able to do that. It was a stupid thing to do. It was wrong. And he sold the country out because he was so compromised. Anyway, that's my humble analysis.
Yeah, well, there you go. So there probably is something to it then.
So yeah, and it all goes. There's a procurator fiscal, and you know it's a deep story, it links in with the whole network. And so what's happened in Holland is that a paedophile network has just been busted there, hasn't it? That's connected with politicians.
And then there's the Belgian one back in the late 80s. It seems to go in rings. Have you noticed that?
Yes.
Right, in cycles. It's almost like they're almost like psyops in themselves to destroy people's faith in their society and their government and everything.
Well, that's part of the plan, isn't it?
Yes.
What is it somebody said? I can't remember what I was watching there, but the idea was that Bill Clinton was put in to destroy people's faith in politicians, and George Bush was to destroy people's faith in the whole system or something, I don't know.
And Obama's, you know, hype and then complete failure and turnaround was to destroy faith in elections.
Mm. Yeah, because the Diebold scandal, you know, or what should be a Diebold scandal that hasn't really come out yet, that should come out soon, is that the voting machines were owned by the Republican Party, or there is no party. They you know, no. they just choose who they want.
No, that's all bullshit. Sorry, I don't want to say that, but yeah, that's all made up.
Yeah, so, oh, there's James, big one. Right, okay. There's a comment from James in the chat room. Not only that, but the gold market is 100% manipulated by the Fed in order to keep the dollar working, because if gold hits 2,000, all bets are off. The Fed falls in 24 hours. JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, and the rest of those scumbags do the Federal Reserve's bidding in the market to keep the price of gold low. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I used to work with JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs, and they have an almost pathological obsession with the price of gold and silver.
Well, isn't the idea that a corporation itself is a psychopathic entity?
You know, when it gets to that level, yes, absolutely it is. They can't function in any other capacity. It actually becomes a monster by itself. There's no difference between Goldman Sachs and Jimmy Savile, J.P. Morgan, and, you know, Ted Bundy. It's the same thing. It's that psychopathic, pathological personality expressed in a corporate entity in much the same way that Britain became a psychopathic expression of the psychopath Tony Blair.
So we find ourselves in a psychopathic society. Now, it's unsustainable because psychopaths need food, the psychopathic entity needs to survive and run, you know, run off energy. And it runs off of a host. If it was a parasite, it would be a host. And the host is starting to scratch its skin. What can you see signs of that happening? Thomas, is there hope?
I'm not sure of your allegory there. Do you mean signs that the psychopathic system is collapsing?
Yeah, that the humanity is waking up and as a whole is starting to scratch this parasite away.
Well, when I started writing about this, almost no one was doing it. There was not, especially certainly not in the alternative, there was little or no talk of psychopaths. It was reptilians and, you know, and then like the kind of racist aspects of the conspiracy, you know, the anti-Semitism and stuff like that. But no one was talking about, and even the anti-Catholic thing and stuff like that, but nobody was talking about psychopaths in it. And I was very interested in the subject from my time of working in both JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs and Citibank as a graphic designer. I wasn't a money man. So I was aware of how they functioned and how they worked, and I wanted to tell as many people as possible of my experience of being in these nests of corporate psychopaths, because I felt that if they could actually understand these things in their own life, they could scale it up to the bigger picture. And it took off very, very quickly for me, amazingly so. You know, for someone who was a small book on a small publisher, and I didn't have any budget or anything. And the warning flags, now that I think about it, came in very early. One of the first interviews I was asked to do was in Playboy with John Ronson, you know, John Ronson, the Guardian Channel 4 guy who makes fun of conspiracy theories. And he had a book that came out a good bit after mine called The Psychopath Test, which he basically trivializes the whole thing and makes fun of the whole idea that psychopaths run the world. And the book was actually trashed even by Robert Hare, who was the world's foremost academic resource on psychopathology. And so I just remember I refused to do the interview because I was actually slagging off. I didn't call him a psychopath, but I was slagging off Hugh Hefner in the book. So I said I would be an absolute hypocrite if I took a paycheck from took a payday by a Playboy. And so I politely declined. And then so, you know, you know, my profile got bigger and bigger, and then all of a sudden everybody in this alternative movement was using the term psychopath to talk about this, and it was becoming very powerful because people could have something they could sell to their friends. They weren't walking up and saying anymore they're reptilians. They were saying they're psychopaths, and here's actual medical psychological, neurological MRI scans to show that these are a different kind of human. And it's hit the history of the world, and it makes sense. So it was becoming a very powerful thing very quickly. And, and then the next thing you know, they started to talk about it in the mainstream, but they started to do it in such a jokey, fun way. So first they tried to take ownership of the subject to try and kill it off through triviality. And now they're trying to make out that it ain't so bad and psychopaths are a good thing. Kevin Dutton, who's an evolutionary psychologist, whatever the hell that is, at the University College London, wrote a book called The Wisdom of Psychopaths. And it's basically saying that psychopaths are great for humanity. We would have a crap world without them. And, you know, there's even a TV show starting on Channel 4 called about, like, unleashing your inner psychopath. So now they're trying to, I actually predicted this would happen in my second book, Defeat the Demons. I said first they would try to trivialize it, and then when that wouldn't work, the next thing they'd do is try and normalize it. And they're in the process now trying to normalize psychopathology, because more and more people are looking at Tony Blair and going, uh-oh, psychopath. And that guy Nestle who said that water wasn't a human right, uh-oh, psychopath. And it's happening more and more. And so now they're trying to take ownership of it. It shows the power of a small alternative movement. Now, I'm not trying to take, you know, credit for this myself, because other people have been there with me doing it, but it just shows how powerful this alternative movement is, that the fact that they would go to the level they did to actually try and disrupt the work that I've done by bringing in people from mainstream journalism. Now, having said that, do we have them on the run? I don't know. Have we scratched them? I don't think so. They're very clever and very devious. And they've actually tried to, they're undermining my work, and that's okay. And they've sent their shills and other people out after me to try and take me down or compromise me in my own way. And it hasn't worked because I'm just the kind of person who wouldn't care anyway. And because I know in my heart that what I'm doing is right and what I'm doing is good, because, and I know, and it is helping ordinary people who've been abused in daily relationships by these things through bullying and so on. So that'll always be there. I don't think we'll ever undermine the psychopaths in power through any kind of war or any kind of, like, we know you. But what we can do is we can walk away from these bastards and not have anything to do with them. We can, our power will be our refusal. And my mantra in my life is no contact ever again. And I feel the same way about the political system and the corporate system. No compliance. Walk away. Do not try to feed their system by trying to change it, alter it, voting, overthrowing them, or anything like that. You put a psychopath out of business one way and one way only, and that's by behaving like they do not exist.
Absolutely. So, from our little country cottages in the midst of nowhere, have you got any kind of, how would you personally like to experience the world in, say, 3 years' time, 5 years' time? How would daily life be for you?
Well, I'm going to say something that people might perceive as being very negative, but it's very liberating, okay? If you're an alcoholic or a drug addict, or you have some other kind of behavioral problem, they always say that the first step to a cure is acknowledging that you have that problem, you know? So we now acknowledge that we have a problem on this planet, and it's called the psychopathic control grid. These psychopaths have basically taken over this planet. Now you go around the world, 99% of people, 96% of people in sort of like high functioning environments are not psychopaths. They're decent, kind. I meet people from every race, every religion. I go all over. I travel everywhere. And most people I meet are lovely. Most human beings do not want a miserable life. They do not want to exploit other human beings. And that's the human race for you, okay? I've really come round to the belief and the idea that we're actually living in hell. I know this sounds kind of controversial, but I think the Gnostics and the Cathars were right when they said that, that human beings live on a planet and this is basically hell. And it ain't so bad because it's not as bad as the hell in the Bible or anything like that, but it's still ultimately hell. It's actually a corrupt in reality that's been extremely damaged by these pathological entities. I think some of them genuinely are non-human in form. You know, whatever they call, whatever demons or the djinn are, I think there's actually an aspect of reality to that. And we've been damaged, and it goes right back to the Bible, particularly in the West. I think the Cathars and the Gnostics were onto something when they said that the Jehovah of the Bible was actually a psychopathic demon pretending to be God and basically pretended to create the earth and impose this defective world on man. And that's what the fall of man and going from Eden and paradise into the wilderness. The wilderness was to put us in what is hell today. We're never going to make heaven of this reality. This is why I have a big problem with the New Age kind of movement that all is light and all is good. But what we can do is make hell the best hell we can. I know that sounds strange, but we can actually, we always will have some kind of evil in the system, because that's ultimately probably what human consciousness exists for. It's an experience, fluctuation between good and bad, up and down, male and female, positive and negative. And from that, probability and possibility tangents are spooled forward into the quantum field. And from that, we create the universe going forward. So we have to have flux. We have to have duality. We have to have friction in order to create these probability and possibility tangents going forward. We will never defeat the psychopaths fully. We will never remove evil from the earth. But what we can do is we can learn through our creative intentions and our ability as creative human beings to generate a more compassionate understanding of each other. So therefore, if we can actually get people to not be, the greatest tool the psychopathic entity has used against us has been divide and conquer. And I'm seeing that sadly in the alternative movement. I'm seeing people pointing fingers at this group or that group. We have to be the first group that says, no, I will not acquiesce to false anti-Semitism, anti-Catholicism, anti this, that, and the other. I will not be made to hate a Muslim. I will not be made to dislike, you know, this person or this ethnic group or this religion or this race. We've got to even extend it as far as, you know, people's choices and what they want to believe. Their love, they're one of the reasons the alternative movement is so powerful is because we do not have a formal structure. They've tried to impose formal structures on us through things like Occupy, failed miserably, and that's good. And things like the Zeitgeist movement, it's failed, good. Our refusal and our non-engagement is our greatest weapon. We must become consciousness insurgents as individuals now. And working through creativity and compassion, develop our possibilities and our full potential as a species going forward. We're a damaged species in many ways, and that's because we haven't fully evolved. So if you ask me, JP, where would you want to see the human race in 3 years' time? And myself in 3 years' time, I'd like to see all of us develop, evolve just a little bit further away from the psychopathic structure and more towards a creative, compassionate understanding of ourselves and individuals, and do not be manipulated and divided as easily as we currently are. Can we achieve it? Absolutely we can. Will we defeat the psychopaths? No, but we will win. We will win the race to be the best humans we can possibly be. I truly believe that. It doesn't matter what a horrible cesspool we're in at times. You look at what happened in Kenya this week. It's absolutely revolting. It just shows how sick these bastards who run the world are. But that doesn't mean that you, me, and anyone else should deny ourselves living the best and the best life we can possibly live. And so that's where I hope all of us will be in 3 years' time, living the best life that we can possibly live.
Beautiful. You know what it reminds me of? You'll remember this from last week. Outside the wall, the ones who really love you walk up and down, and it's the people who have broken out from the matrix, the control grid, whatever you want to call it, the theater set, the Truman set that has been implanted into our brains, really, that doesn't really exist outside of it, but we have to kind of get over that. And that's what I think the wall is about. He's such a visionary, Roger Waters. I just love the guy.
And he admits his mistakes. And he admits that he was a bad man. Like, when I saw the wall in Dublin recently, he sang along with himself doing Mother at Earl's Court, the original film from 1980. And he said, "I'm now playing along with that messed, effed up, horrible little bastard that was Roger." And this is an important thing too. Are we still alive on the air?
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah. We're about 5 minutes away from the end.
This is an important thing for your listeners to understand, that making mistakes and sometimes going down the wrong path and sometimes believing in stuff that turns out to be a load of rubbish later is as important as finding the nuggets of truth. Because you will learn from your mistakes. And learning from your mistakes is much more valuable than learning from your successes. Because when you learn from your successes, you sit on your laurels and you bask in your success. But when you learn from your failures, you're moving forward because you've actually got two functions on either side of the experience to work with. One is failure. One is the resolution of that failure into something meaningful. And so this is important. So it does, you know, Roger Waters, it was a very deep guy. That show was a very moving, anarchist, kind of like anti-authoritarian, amazing spectacular, as I saw recently. But ultimately, he was not afraid to admit that he was a bad man in his life. I mean, he caused a lot of trouble for his fellow band members in Pink Floyd. And that's okay in the end. Once he got there and realized that he made mistakes. Lots of people have done things in their lives they shouldn't have done. They've hurt people, they've damaged people. But the difference between a normal person and a psychopath is a normal person will actually feel bad about it and try to make amends and try to somehow put themselves in the position of the person that they caused the damage to and make it up somehow. A psychopath doesn't give a damn. They'll just move on to the next thing. And so it's very important for us to learn and embrace our mistakes. And if you did something that made you look really foolish in the past, like you went into a cocktail party and you said the world is run by reptilian shapeshifters because you were in the early stages of waking up, instead of being traumatized and embarrassed by that, learn how to laugh at it. And that's really important, I think. And or if you believed in something, if you're one time a member of a group and you thought a UFO was going to come down and save the world, and it didn't happen, don't be shameful about it as if you're a fool and a sucker. Just laugh at the experience and say, "Ah, that's life. What can you do?" And see the humor in it. Because I'm a great believer in the statement, "Feck them if they can't take a joke." And the first person you should always learn to laugh at is yourself, because it keeps you humble and it keeps you in check. It puts the brakes on.
Excellent, Thomas. I think that just about sums everything up, brings it to a neat a conclusion, and it's been a delight and a real pleasure. I hope you don't mind. I did realize I was rattling on a little bit about my own stuff, but it's just been nice to exchange stuff with you.
Yeah, it was fun. I enjoyed them too very much.
Thank you very much, Thomas.
So last time on, I'd love to come back again if you want me.
Sure, I'd love to. You know, just even if you just want to come on and have a chin wag with another old fellow from the '60s.
Yeah, definitely, I'd definitely good for that.
Bless your heart. Thank you very much. And where's my little outro? Where has it gone? Ever Beyond outro. There we go. Good night, everybody. We'll see you in a few minutes with Frank Jordan with Healings and Meditations, followed by Evolution with Eva Moore. Good night. beyond, beyond, beyond.